Impact Leaders, the podcast on impact leaders, influencers, and institutions supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. And this is your host, JP Dahlman. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I must begin today by saying that this is very challenging time that we're facing in the world. We were already facing the world's biggest challenges in terms of sustainability and climate change. And now, with the virus and the lockdowns of countries all over, it is a rather surreal time. Personally, I just want to say that my heart and prayers go to all those suffering, to all the professionals and staff helping, and everyone around the world. Notwithstanding, I am hopeful that things will eventually improve and we will overcome this difficult time. Therefore, we must not stop and continue to create awareness about sustainable impact investing so we can keep the momentum and great work that we have done to date. So in today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have two very special guests again. We have Andres Guyan and Dominic Sequeira as our guests. Hi, Andres. Hi, Dominic. Welcome.
JP. Hi, JP. How's it going?
Good, good. Thank you so much for being with us today. And as part of this coronavirus lockdown period, we're all in our own places. Today, you gentlemen are in wonderful Zurich in Switzerland. That's right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
And I am down here in beautiful Kent in the southeast of England. As it is our tradition, I'll just give a quick intro to you guys. About Andres Guyan, he's the portfolio manager and one of the co-founders at Carnot Capital. Prior to founding the company in 2007, Andres was an analyst of engineering, real estate, and electricity companies at Volatis Bank. Previously, he held leading positions in financial analysis at Bank Vontobel and at Kepler Equities. He also has an array of degrees and other titles, but I'll just leave it there for now. And then, Andres, if you want to add more, please do. And about Dominic Sequeira, he's the head of business development, Carnot Capital. He's responsible for business and capital development, overseeing the fundraising, marketing, and investor relations over of the company. Prior to joining Carnot Capital in 2018, Dominic was responsible for investor relations at Knight Vink, a deep value asset manager, which specializes in engaging with companies and the markets to realize value through a strategic and corporate change. Anything that you would like to add, gentlemen?
No, that's it. I think that's, yeah, quite to the point.
Perfect. Yep. So as it is our tradition as well, our first question is always to our guests to just gain your personal or company view and definition of what is sustainable and impact investing. Andres, sure, you want to start?
I'll take this one, JP.
Okay, perfect.
So for us, sustainable investing is investing in businesses that have products, technologies, and services which we feel contribute to a cleaner, more efficient, and productive future. Ideally, this would be a future where everyone enjoys a high standard of living, but is also experiencing a high quality of living. Impact investing goes a little bit further. And for us, that means engaging for the solution of environmental and social problems while also generating a financial return. We feel that there's an opportunity to create value by investing in businesses who, through their products and technologies, solve growing issues on the world, such as climate change and the scarcity of resources.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Dominic. And about your company, Carnot Capital, and I'll say this a couple of times, but do go to carnotcapital.com where you can find a lot of really good information about them. But Carnot Capital is an investment management company specialized in the area of energy and resource efficiency. They founded the company in 2007 in Zurich, and in 2013 received the permission asset manager for collective investments by the Swiss Financial Markets Supervisory Authority, FINMA. If you don't mind, gentlemen, I'm going to also read quickly just your mission, which I picked up from the website, which, you know, I think is a good point to start with. And it says, as signatory of the principle for responsible investment, you measure the impact of your investments by mapping the UN 17 Sustainable Development Goals SDGs. Impact is fully integrated in your investment process, and through your direct dialogue and engagement with your portfolio companies, you create a more than just the financial performance. Who would like to start on this one? Who can tell me more about Karnow Capital?
Yes, the main points you have mentioned. We are a specialized equity asset management company, and we are specialized in energy and resource efficiency. And that means that we have been dealing with these very popular issues now with of climate change and resource scarcity for more than 12 years now. And well, yeah, we launched the Energy Efficiency Fund in 2007, and then followed by the Resource Efficiency Fund in 2015. The second fund is broader. We do invest in energy saving technologies, but also in topics like recycling, water treatment or food preservation, air cleaning and things like that. And so clearly these funds that we managed are very focused products in the listed equity segment. And so niche products, if you want. And assets under management, they were growing nicely until 2015. But then I have to say, we had a hard time when the oil price collapsed and the whole investment case of energy prices rising and rising did not work any longer. So we did lose assets, but now we are growing again since the topic of climate change has become so popular and omnipresent, I would say.
Okay. And when you set up the company in 2007, was it already very clear that you were setting up, you know, a sustainable investment fund, but for use of a better phrase, or did you start just focusing on energy as such, and then you started evolving to create the reports and everything else that we will talk about later in the episode?
Now, the second point is true. At the time, there were a lot of sustainable funds around, but we thought these funds are not that sustainable, really, because sustainability has also a financial aspect. And a lot of these funds, they just disappeared because they were investing in business models that were not sustainable in the end. So companies that went basically bust. So we realized that energy is indeed a topic that is a major challenge of our civilization, obviously. And we have the problem of increasing prices, of scarcity, and growing environmental problems. Now, what really made us found the company then was the conviction that reducing energy consumption is the most attractive business case, because it's very often it's economical to save energy. So it's a profitable investment. And we were convinced that investing in saving energy is a good business and offers attractive investing opportunities. But of course, reducing energy consumption is also the most environmentally friendly way to address these challenges. So what I want to say is the sustainability aspect came only a bit later. First, we thought it's just a very interesting business case. It came later, but then from 2012 on, we involved the sustainability aspect in our investment process. And later on, from 2015 or so, we established also an impact investing process with documentation and everything.
That's good. And I like that because, again, it shows, you know, the longevity, but then also, you know, I love the word evolution. It can evolve, you know, quite a few years now. It's over 10, right, to develop everything that you are offering. And then in terms of, so right now you have energy fund and the resources fund, and I think you are launching or just launched a fund which is around circular economy, if that's correct?
That's right, JP. We have our two flagship funds, which are the Energy Efficiency Fund and the Resource Efficiency Fund, and we recently launched a circular economy index together with Bank Vontobel here in Zurich. And this index you can use to create certificates around it and give investors access to a portfolio of 20 companies which we feel fit ideally into that theme.
Perfect. And then you manage about, I think that from some of the other conversations we have, you currently manage about 70 million altogether?
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
And then, but you have been, again, as you said, being lucky in some ways and are growing at least until for the first part of this year, and you have some more funds coming in, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Perfect.
We had, I would say, major inflows from bigger investors, and we had a couple but very minor redemptions from retail clients that shows, well, the nervousness of some investors, but of the very basic interest of bigger institutional investors on the other side.
Okay. And then you mentioned in terms of the kind of the performance, you know, to date, and obviously welcome your views on what you think is going to happen, especially, you know, on equities, given that everything that took place in the last couple of weeks. But performance today and performance going forward, you say you had a bit of a challenging time, but altogether, how have your funds performed and what have been kind of the highlights?
Well, the challenging time comes mainly from the automotive sector. Now, the automotive sector is obviously a big topic when it comes to the shift to, you know, away from fossil fuel. So we do have an exposure to the automotive sector. We have actively reduced the exposure, but that was a difficult time. 2018, 2019 was good. Now it's more difficult again. We have small cap buys, and in times like this, this is not an advantage, I have to say. Well, going forward, we are talking to companies every day, and clearly they are even reinforcing their trends to come up with more environmentally friendly products because they clearly see it as an opportunity. They are convinced that when we come out of this coronavirus crisis, these efforts towards a more environmentally friendly economic model will be reinforced finally in the end.
Okay. And then in terms of maybe at that point, there's two things that came to mind. So in terms of the performance itself overall, you guys have been kind of above your benchmark, but it has been a bit up and down, right? Any particular numbers that you would like to share maybe for some of the potential investors that would like to learn a bit more? Anything that is, you know, publicly you can talk about?
You're right. The outperformance, underperformance, that fluctuates over time. What I can say is that since the inception of the fund in 2007, which was shortly before the financial crisis, since the inception, we do have an outperformance in comparison to the European overall market. And that was despite the financial crisis. Then we had a recession in 2012. And as I mentioned, the collapse in the oil price in 2015. So sometimes we do have a beta of more than one. But I think this is inevitable. If you really want to have an impact fund, you cannot copy the index and sell it as an impact fund.
I agree with you. So you have, as Dominic had mentioned to me before, kind of one strategy and three funds, right? So you have your kind of investment process and you have your sustainability and your impact assessment all built in. And you mentioned automotive sectors as one of the sectors that you look into. Are there any other specific sectors that you really focus on, or is it more about the companies that you look at?
I'll take this one as well. Essentially, our strategy and philosophy circles around a value approach. We look for quality companies and try to purchase them at relatively cheap prices. Now, that is a standard for us. Where do we look for these companies? It's really in the energy or energy efficiency sense. We look for industrial companies, companies that are in the transport sector, but also in building technologies. So basically anywhere where energy is being used, we feel that you can also save it. And we want to invest into those companies that create the products and technologies to save this energy. So rather than us focusing on an energy transition to renewable energy companies, we feel you can achieve a lot more in terms of efficiency and making your existing infrastructure more efficient. On the resource efficiency side, we look also, in addition to those three sectors I just mentioned, we also look for all the other resources. So we look also for food. There we are invested into fishery. We also look into agriculture, so the efficient use of agricultural space and getting more yield per square foot. This is something that's key for us, but we're also concerned and looking into the topic of clean air. So companies that proactively create technologies which clean the air, make standards of living better, but also the same goes for water. So companies that analyze, measure water, or can even create tools and toolkits to make water more potable and essentially better to drink, less of chemicals and so on. And what we feel is where the, sort of the key is here is that we want to look for valuable companies with valuable business models that have a logical view to the future. They want to improve something somehow in some way. And that's key for us.
If I may add one aspect, yes. We only look for companies and products that are established in the market. So there are plenty of companies around that tell the world we have found the most revolutionary technology that will change the world. But that's not the kind of companies we're looking for. We do look for innovation, but innovation that has established itself in the market. So for companies that make profit, so we will not find a company in our portfolio that is loss-making, I should say consistently loss-making.
Mm-hmm. And then a lot of other investment funds and that have not done anything or enough yet on building this into their valuations and models. So you, from portfolio management perspective, so what is it that you do, perhaps the examples that you can share specifically to, in your models, in your analysis, to work out and see the extra value that is not being shown by others or by other reports or by research analysis available out there? What is it that you do differently that others could ideally replicate or learn from you?
Sure. So, the important thing with us is that unlike larger asset managers or institutional asset managers, for us, impact and sustainability is, a factor premium. We use the dialogue and the engagement with our companies and the discussions we have about impact, trying to learn more about what the company does on that level, helps us to understand the companies on a much deeper level. A good example of this, and maybe Andres, you can go deeper into it as well, is a case that we had with Belimo last year. Belimo was a company that produces technology and products for the building to create a more efficient building, and amongst other things, also a ventilation flap. And one part which we did in our engagement with the company was to determine and ask them to deliver us clear results as to how much more efficient a building is when these ventilation flaps are implemented. We persisted and we didn't want just some speculative numbers, but we essentially pushed hard enough for them to see the value add for their marketing purposes to actually go to their clients and ask them for the specific numbers and the specific statistics. And what we received actually were results that were even better than what we speculated they would be. So this was a very pleasant surprise for us and showed that Belimo is actually even more sustainable and has an even bigger impact than we initially thought. And that is kind of a part of our philosophy.
Okay. But then how can you then put that into your calculations so that you can realize, that this is going to create more value for your investors?
Well, you see, we are very focused. So we are into basically three segments. That's building technology, that's industrial technology, transport. In these segments, energy is used. So we know these sectors for a long time, and we're in a position to discuss the products and the markets with the companies. And then we ask, what's the value proposition of your products, and how much energy does it save, and is it good from your client's perspective? So how much does the client pay? What does he get? And to give you again the example of Belimo, they produce an intelligent valve for heating and ventilation that costs maybe $5,000. So the question is, how much energy does this device save? And if it's around energy for $5,000 a year, roughly speaking, then the payback period is 1 year. So 1 year. This is an extremely attractive investment. And this is basically the reason why Belimo is very profitable. They have operating margins of close to 20%, and they're growing every single year for the last almost 40 years, except for 2 years. So they have been growing because their products are excellent. They make sense from a financial point of view. So this is the way we discuss the products with the companies, and then we eventually invest, buy shares.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because sometimes what happens to me, and I think what happens to some of the people that are not doing what you're doing, is that, that mix between what is the impact that this is generating versus, some of the hidden value that is there that people kind of realize that the company is generating, right? And it's making it more sustainable, and therefore also is making it more profitable. And that's kind of where I was going, because it's kind of how do I value that the way that the LIM operates and hasn't been reported yet? You know, it has an extra value that potentially other analysts are not seeing. And that is basically what I hear, correct me if I'm wrong, is that that's where your added value comes in terms of the analysis you make and the valuation that you put into that hidden value effectively. Is that right?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. For us, like anything else, it is something that you should know about the company. And only if you ask those specific questions, you actually drill a little bit deeper than the usual biannual analyst call, which is mainly very financial heavy and governance heavy as well. What we try to do is we try to have and be able to ask a different set of questions, questions which we then have the answers to and our competing funds don't. And that's our edge.
Perfect. And then do you...
One simple aspect, JP. Yes. Today, Belim was a 3 billion Swiss franc company. When it started, it was well below 1 billion. But not every fund can buy Belimo shares because it's not that liquid, despite the capitalization of 3 billion. And it's really a stock for investors that understand the company. They buy the shares, they are in contact with the company, but they keep the shares. It's not a share that you can buy and sell, you know, whenever you think the timing is right.
Yeah, so it's a bit more long term. And then do you consider any of the, you know, upcoming regulations or current regulations and potentially some of the other risks, you know, like litigation risks and other that could affect the value of the companies? Or is that still too early?
I would say, to be honest, for us, this is part of our investment thesis. We expect that there's going to be a lot of regulation coming in the next couple of years, which will push companies to be more sustainable in either their footprint, but also their handprint as well. And this is where we don't see this as a burden, but we feel like that is the wind in our sails, if you will. It's something that will help our companies to grow and gain market share in comparison to their competition. And we feel confident that our selection process helps us pick the winners of this new regulation that will come into place.
And then one thing that perhaps we didn't mention yet, so some of these companies, you know, do have ESG ratings as well, right? I think this is something that we, in one of the many calls we had, Dominic, we talked about, but sometimes the kind of ESG ratings are not in line with, you know, how sustainable, how good the companies are in terms of as a sustainable investment. Is there anything that you can share with us on that topic?
I can share an experience of ours. What we see every day when we're analyzing these companies and doing our own ESG analysis, we see immense discrepancies between the ratings and the articulation around and reasoning around why a certain rating is placed by these very large rating agencies. I won't name any names. And with the way that we analyze it, the results that we come up with it. And what we've determined the reason for this being the discrepancy is that a lot of these rating agencies have to cover an immense amount of companies. This is in the thousands. The only way this is achieved is through mechanization. So usually the task of establishing a rating or an initial rating and so on is outsourced where labor is cheap, and the task is done in a very menial way. So you go to the website, you search for sustainability report. If they have one, great, that's a tick. You search for gender equality report. If they don't have one, ooh, that's very, very bad. The actual standpoint of the company, so what they are actually doing, becomes a little bit irrelevant. And so we see this, that there is definitely a lag behind of the way that we interpret a company through our dialogue and our deeper research on this level and the ESG rating that it has.
Mm-hmm. And yes, we do have a checklist, an ESG checklist. We do have analysis. We also have a checklist for the impact that is maybe a bit shorter, but we think we have an understanding for the companies, and the result is probably in a lot of cases even better than the result of the large agencies. I don't want to blame these agencies, but to measure the impact of a company, you really have to understand it, I think. And that's hard for, you know, when you sit in a foreign country and you just check the website.
Yeah. Again, I'm kind of digging on this because it's something that's kind of recurring. So, you know, we just done a webinar and there was a lot of questions about ESG ratings and reporting. And then obviously we'll talk about impact in a second. But what I hear again is that although you can have inverted commas formal ESG rating and information to be able to really see what is happening, you need to do an extra ESG analysis and checklist of the companies to make sure that even though they may not have the rating and the check and the box ticked on the traditional big firms, you may find that they are actually doing what is necessary. That's what I hear.
Exactly.
So if we mention about identifying and measuring impact, and I like just to reinforce and everything you said, and I picked this phrase from one of your co-founders, Andres. So Roel Helbling says, we don't buy sustainability reports, we buy good companies. And it's something that I can hear across, you know, every time that I see what you guys are doing. But in terms of, you know, and you have that really good reports as well. I recommend people to look at them. You have the kind of efficiency energy report and the kind of efficiency resources report, which have this section, which is the impact section as well, the impact validation. So how did you come up with your methodology and the factors you look at?
Yeah. So how did we come up with the methodology? Well, we are lucky that we have our colleague, Dr. Andreas Walter. He holds a PhD in environmental economics. And when impact came up, he really, you know, he was enthusiastic and he sat down and wrote a very good piece of paper about sustainable and impact investing. So he wrote a good book or a very good paper that you can find on our webpage about sustainable and impact investing in general and how we do it. And yet together we developed that process that we apply today. And you probably also want to know how we measure the impact, because that's the difficult question, right? How do we measure impact? And here we most of all look at the product. So we really ask what products of a company's offering does save energy or does save water or soil, food, etc. And then we analyze the effect of that product, how much it is in the sales of a company. And so this is the impact part. And we also look deeply into the financial aspect. I already touched on it. Mm-hmm. So product has to make sense from a financial point of view. Simply speaking, if it's too expensive, it won't be bought and the impact will be zero, as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And also on a company level, a profitable company with good margins can invest and grow. And as the company grows, the impact gets bigger. So we really think good financials are important in impact investing. So that's it in short.
Okay. And then what I noticed that you have is that effectively you build kind of a heat map, right? Which then is linked to some specific SDGs. And then you also have within the heat map, this kind of significant impact, substantial impact, considerable impact, and low impact. So if I can just dig one bit more on it. So if you look at a product, normally how do you look at, let's say, a specific product and how that can be ranked in the heat map in one way or another?
Yeah. So maybe about the heat map first. So it's an aggregation of the impact analysis of all the companies in the portfolio. Mm-hmm. So you have the companies 1 to 30 on one scale and on the other, the SDGs that we examine. We do not examine all 17 SDGs, just about 5 in the current efficient energy fund. And how do we assess that impact? So maybe you have the SDG about climate change. So we go and ask, how big is the impact of this and that product in the company? Is it big or not so big? And how big is the share in sales? So if it's very big, the share in sales is small, then we say, well, it's medium. From 0 to 4, then it's maybe a 2. And if it's a company like Belima that we mentioned, well, basically all products save energy and the impact is huge. So definitely a 4 in the case Belima in terms of climate change measures. maybe in another aspect, infrastructure or so, we always look at the sub-goals, right? There it is zero. So you have different shades of colors in that heat map, and you get a feeling how strongly each of these SDGs is supported by the portfolio companies. That's the idea of this heat map.
Okay, I understand it now. So it's a 1-4 scale, and the analysis of the products, and then obviously, you know, the financials on top of that. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that helps me at least.
You may say it's a very simple approach, but, you know, looking into a company and make up your mind, how much does this company support this or that goal? Then at least you look into it and you do not just pick some kind of information that in the end doesn't make sense. So you have a color and you have a shade of color.
Yes.
But at least per company and on an aggregated portfolio level.
Yes, that's fine and that's great, right? So we have had, you know, some various people, you know, very successful and well-known people that talk about measurement actually not being as important as people make it to be, and that you have to like simplify, you know, to be able to basically get on with it and not kind of overcomplicate things. So I think that's perfect. And just the way that you explain that thing, it just makes so much more sense. So I think if somebody's listening to the podcast now, they can look at the report. And just by listening to how you explain it, you know, it makes it quite easy to understand and for them to create their own way of doing it, which I think is always the idea. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was going to just ask you as well, just to go back to kind of your clients that you currently have. You mentioned a little bit of the movement, some of the retailers, you know, going away, some of new larger investors coming in. How is this all evolving, you know, in terms of what have you seen in terms of the interest, perhaps, of the type of clients, you know, slash investors that you are seeing that are coming to you and that you're talking to?
Sure. So clients that are coming to us, they are family offices, advisors, and independent asset managers. Basically, these are institutions which have taken the topic to heart, and they realize that these topics are valuable investment opportunities. In terms of evolution, what are we seeing? We're seeing that banks are also starting to come around. They're starting to develop their own strategies for marketing purposes. But I think they're starting to see that, you know, it's not just a trend or a theme. I think, you know, they're approaching us to also partner with us and partner with specialists in the respective field. And when they do partner, usually it's through creating a dedicated product. So I think this is an evolution that will crystallize a lot more in the next year or two.
Okay. And it's a couple of questions actually I'm thinking about here, kind of combined with where we are today, what's happened until today and the future. Does being effectively an active investor like you are help make you different and therefore have more interest from investors to come to you?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Active investing is coming back, and being a long-standing good strategy, you're definitely welcome into the door with a lot of these investors. In our experience, as a focused and engaged investor, you know, we also feel that it's basically impossible to do impact without being active. So when we combine the two, saying we're an active investor that incorporates impact, we get the meetings and we have the traction. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Because on the other side, I do listen to some of the, you know, biggest experts out there. And I think I mentioned in the last podcast as well, I was listening to, you know, the CEO of State Street and others. I think BlackRock is very big on this as well. So we have like ETFs, right? And the market is growing and people are putting, you know, all these labels on sustainable and impact ETFs. But these are by nature passive, right? And they're growing. So how do you see that?
I think it's a natural evolution of things. When a new topic like this becomes readily available, what you first want is you want as many people as possible to learn about it and to understand it. So all these ETFs that are popping up definitely help promote impact investing. But I urge clients and investors, when it comes to impact, to really read the fine print and look inside, check the positions that are in these ETFs, check the phrasing around the stock selection. And once you do that, I think many investors will clearly see the difference between an active investor doing everything he can in that area and a passive investment vehicle.
Isn't that one of the challenges of the future, right? In terms of, you know, who has the time and the teams to be analyzing all of these? That's the big question mark.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there will never be enough time or manpower, regardless of if you're one of the big asset managers or a small person like us. I think there will be two streets, two avenues. Either you analyze everything and you analyze it with not enough depth or granularity, or you focus like us on a specific sector or even a specific portfolio, and you do that really well.
Yeah, but JP, come back to your question. Of course, that's a challenge because time is also a scarce resource, right? But when you have a product, I think as a professional, when you look for the portfolio and you just check the positions, then you have a very good impression if the portfolio is congruent with the label of the product. And I dare say, let's say if you have an impact product for, be it climate change, and then you look into it and then you say telecom company and an insurance company and social media company. So for me, it's hard to see what these positions have to do with climate change. The issuer can explain it, but it's hard to see for me at least. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of the opportunity on how we scale funds like yours and we transition more capital into sustainable impact investing. So what was stopping major investors coming and, you know, giving you perhaps even the same amount or double the amount that you currently manage?
Well, AUM size is a key factor prohibiting institutional investors from working with us. I mean, it's a challenge for us, of course, but at the same time, I think it's an opportunity for really sophisticated institutional investors who see the value add of impact to partner with smaller investment managers like us, specialists. So yeah, it's a challenge and an opportunity at the same time. To answer your question of how we could scale funds like ours, I think it's through partnerships. Banks, like I mentioned before, for example, they can create actively managed certificates around, you know, derivative themes of our, for example, resource fund, you know, and we can work with them providing our know-how and our impact research and measurement. But I also feel, you know, the traditional way of managed accounts is a good way to work with institutional investors, you know, where these investors can pick out certain best qualities of us and have them produced on a managed account. This is something that we're seeing develop as well.
Perfect. So in terms of, there's a point there about the regulatory side as well, in terms of, you know, how some of the investors can allocate funds to investment managers of your size. And I think that there's something potentially that we should look into, maybe not for this episode, but thought that is something that is worth mentioning. But I'll reiterate what you said before. I think that what you made the points in terms of the partnerships, that is a very good point. And I'm sure that before you realize, you will have people coming and knocking on your door to do this. How just on a personal level, I was talking to Dominic about this before as well. But Andres, what do you think is going to happen with the market and all this that is going on right now?
Yeah. So my conviction is challenged a bit. We had a couple of calls today and yesterday, and some companies, they are really preparing for a very hard hit.
Yes.
You know, that for really a shutdown for 6-8 weeks. And I mean, I was a bit late, right? Because we were talking to a company. I mean, they plan for a 30% decrease in the automotive market, not car sales, but the deliveries. But I still think that's too hard. That's too hard. Because I tend to be a bit more optimistic because, you know, back in February, we underestimated the impact. We saw it in China and we thought, well, we had the red spots popping up in Europe, in Italy and here and there. And the stock exchange was still holding up well. And then it collapsed. Mm. Maybe the correction is a bit too heavy now, because I'm convinced the recovery will be steep. I've never seen anything else. When you remember back in the financial crisis, we were just discussing, will it be a V-shaped recovery or a U-shaped recovery or an L-shaped? And it was clear it will never be a V-shaped recovery. And what happened? It was a V-shaped recovery. So I've never seen another recovery than a V-shaped recovery.
I like that. That's a positive approach.
I've never seen anything else, really. Mm. Because companies, they stop operations, but they are ready to pick it up again. And then they will pick up operations again. Some of them have an order book. And the supply chain has to be, you know, reactivated, and that will go quite quickly. Of course, consumer sentiment and all that's under pressure, clear. But I still think the recovery will be steep.
Yeah, I just personally, I'm an optimist and very positive all the time. But it's because we haven't experienced something like this on these times, at least. Mm-hmm. And the fact that everything is properly stopped, and obviously affecting in one part, you know, consumers' actual income, and then I'm wondering how much it's going to really affect their behavior afterwards, mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, will they have funds? Will they actually, even if they had funds again, will they behave in the same way? And how is that going to impact, you know, the whole supply chain? That's the only question I have, which I wonder, you know, if then the shape of the recovery will be as deep, as fast. But we really don't know, right? My guess is that it will not be as fast. And we may get a surprise on that respect. And it may, and ideally hoping that it's going to be only 6 or 8 weeks of, you know, like these companies preparing for this, but it could be more if we don't work out solutions and how to deal with the pandemic, right? So I'm being conservative, I think, to say the least.
But let's see. Maybe we will have a medicine to cure the disease. That would be best case, right? If we have a medicine to cure the disease, then you will not be afraid anymore of going to work and to get in contact with other people, because then you know when I get it, yes, I will have a medicine that cures me.
Of course.
Eventually, yeah, or you will have a vaccine, or I don't know what. But the point you mentioned before, don't you think? You know, having the dependencies right now, so, you know, technology from China going to the US, we don't have the vaccines here because they're also produced in China. I mean, maybe that was not a good idea to outsource everything. But then maybe they will relocate some manufacturing and production capacities, and that will also maybe generate some business, no?
Yes. Yes, well, crisis always brings opportunities, right? So, excellent. Okay.
Yes, I agree.
So, just as we're coming to the end of the episode, I just wanted to make sure that people know at least a little bit about you. So, if you can share with us, how was it that you ended up doing what you're doing and focusing on sustainable impact investing? Kind of what drives you, what inspires you in a way today? That would be very, very welcome.
Okay. Now, there is a saying in America, they say, do the right thing. And not burning fossil fuels in gigatons every year, this is definitely not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is probably to look for solutions that we can come away from fossil fuels and preserve the environment, but also preserve our standard of living. So that's probably the motivation. And I think we have entered this process and we will be successful. And that's extremely exciting to look into or to be part of that process.
Nice. What about you, Dominic?
For me personally, I think it's an opportunity, like Andres said, to do the right thing. For me as a client-facing person, as a business developer, I feel like there's a chance here to do something exciting and build something special, but also the chance to innovate and maybe challenge the status quo. You know, challenge how we engage with company and maybe challenge also the existing voting structure and create very interesting and high quality companies.
Great. And is there anything or anyone in particular, sometimes I ask, you know, is there a person, a book that kind of made you change or switch your life into what you're doing today?
Well, no, maybe not change my life, but I was really impressed by Bertrand Piccard, because when he started his endeavor with solar impulse flying around the world on solar energy, he looked like a fool to many. And he didn't even know how he would do it, but he still looked for money. And when he was asked, well, how do you do it? And then he had to say, I don't know yet, but I will do it. So that's what I need the money for. That really impressed me, because we also hear, well, it's not possible and it's too expensive, you cannot do it, etc., etc. But he showed that you have to start going, and then eventually you will see the goal.
The way.
That, yes, eventually you will see the way. And I'm convinced, yes, we will find our way to tackle these challenges.
Very nice. Very nice. Dominic, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I guess for me personally, I found inspiration recently in a book called The New Green Deal by Jeremy Rifkin. And it's really good at describing that the challenges we face today, you know, that it is a gigantic Rubik's Cube that we need to solve and we need to move towards to solve these problems. But what's very clear is that if we don't solve the Rubik's Cube, you know, there won't be one. And so what motivates me is equally the size of the challenge, but also the complicatedness and the intricacies of it is what I find interesting.
Fantastic. And then that's a quite a nice link to one before the last question. So what is an impact leader? You know, what advice would you give to people?
Well, I think an impact leader is someone who listens and strives to deeply understand what the topic is and what other people understand about the topic. You know, impact is not the same thing for person by person. It varies. So I think what's important for an impact leader is to listen what the interpretation is per person and understand every single one.
Nice. Andres?
Well, it's a hard one. Impact leader. Well, maybe, let me say, it's similar to Bertrand Piccard. It's an innovator who has a vision, who, you know, who takes the risk, who takes the money and works very hard for a goal. That's an impact leader, maybe.
I like it. Yeah, I was going to just take what you mentioned about the example before. It's somebody that has a vision and just tries to focus on the what to then work out how the how is going to happen, right? I like that. That's a good one. Any last call to action, guys, for our listeners?
Sure. I think, obviously, you started it on that topic, you know, the coronavirus. We're in a very special phase at the moment. And I don't think anyone really knows how it will end and where it can all still go. The one thing that's clear, however, is that the challenges of climate change and resource scarcity, they will be around even after this crisis, and they will be tackled. And I think in tackling these issues, we are going to find some tremendous investment opportunities for years to come. So I guess my final call to action is that the world is counting on us to change our behavior and also our capital allocations.
Nice. Andres?
Yeah, that's call to action. Yes. No, but I think Dominic, he said it very well.
Perfect.
And I'm convinced when, you know, a lot of efforts will be here to get out of the current crisis. And in German, we say, das Gute mit dem Nützlichen verbinden. So to combine the good with the useful. And I'm sure all these impulses will be directed towards the climate goals, for instance. So building renovation and electric mobility, they will be supported very soon.
And one last question for me is, how can people get in touch with you and Carno Capital?
Now that's simple. Just call Dominic. On our website, you will find all the contact details. And when you call, yes, we pick up the phone, then let's talk.
Brilliant.
And obviously, in true millennial tradition, you can also follow us on Twitter, like our posts on LinkedIn.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Dominic, Andres.
Thank you.
I hope I see you soon. And it is bye for now and until our next episode of Impact Leaders. And God bless you all. Please do remember to check our sponsors' website for upcoming events. Bye-bye.
This was Impact Leaders, Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.